From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 2 years of a big anti-corruption campaign in China have hit lots of big figures. Some see a Communist Party house cleaning as China's years of hyper-economic growth come to an end. Some see a purge of rivals to China's populist strongman leader, Xi Jinping. It is a fascinating moment in the People's Republic with no real roadmap. This hour on Point, Xi Jinping, the anti-corruption campaign, and the future of China. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you see China's next big chapter? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now, three big China watchers. Damian Ma is with us from Chicago, fellow at the Paulson Institute, contributor to The Atlantic, author of In Line Behind a Billion People, How Scarcity Will Define China's Ascent in the Next Decade. Damian Ma, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me back.
It's great to have you. David Lampton joins us from Washington, professor, director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, chairman of the Asia Foundation. His latest book is Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping. David, Mike Lampton, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And with us from San Diego is Susan Shirk, chair of the 21st Century China Program and professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at UC San Diego. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs from 97 to 2000, author of China, Fragile Superpower. Susan Shirk, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks very much, Tom. Good to be with such a good group.
It's fantastic to have you all. We're trying to make sense of this moment. We've picked out the anti-corruption campaign as a way in. There are a lot of ways we could look at this. Susan, let me come first to you. A lot of people are talking about an essay in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend from David Shambaugh at George Washington University. Not a Chicken Little, Sky is Falling guy, generally about China, I believe. But the headline on this essay is The Coming Chinese Crack-Up. He writes in his piece that China's rich are establishing bases outside of China, losing confidence that the end game of communist rule in China has begun. Is the anti-corruption campaign a sign of this somehow? Is it leader Xi Jinping's effort to clean up the country, to rein in political opposition? Do you see a crack-up coming, Susan?
Well, a crack-up, I'm not quite sure what a crack-up means. This was David Shambaugh's essay is really commendable for its boldness and its willingness to contemplate the end of the People's Republic, which I do believe will not be there forever. China is not exempt from the forces of world history. And one of those forces is that in authoritarian regimes, when a leader tries to redistribute the spoils of office, as Xi Jinping is doing in this anti-corruption campaign, he is making it more likely that you're going to get a serious opposition within the elite. And these kinds of political regimes tend to fall as much top-down as bottom-up. So if you do get that kind of pushback, it could trigger a major political change in China. On the other hand, Xi Jinping is extremely popular with the public. And that's a point that David Shambaugh missed in his essay. And that popularity will be a defense of Xi Jinping if he is opposed by other leaders who resent the fact that he's carrying out this purge and feel threatened by it.
Damian Ma in Chicago, how do you read the anti-corruption campaign? Do you see a purge? Do you see a big, powerful economy slowing down, and so the leader has to clean it up because otherwise all kinds of ugliness appears that may not appear when the money's just rolling in, Damian?
Well, I think I see a little bit of both. Clearly, there is some internal politics going on right now as part of the anti-corruption campaign, but I think it's just as important to look at it as a way of creating the political conditions that would enable a more aggressive and significant set of reforms that they're trying to undertake on the economic side. I think those two things are absolutely linked. And just like previous Paramount leader Deng Xiaoping did in the 1980s and 1990s, he had to continuously create the political conditions that would support his very ambitious and significant reforms. And let's be clear, what the Chinese are trying to do right now is extremely dramatic and significant. It's not going to get done overnight or even in a year or two. They've set themselves, a timeline until about 2022. So I suspect we're sort of looking at two acts, where the first act through 2017 is where President Xi and his team are setting the political conditions. A part of that is the anti-corruption campaign. And the second act would be once those enabling conditions are there, I remain cautiously optimistic that you're going to see more significant reforms.
Damien, describe those reforms in brief. I mean, you harken back to Deng Xiaoping. His reforms unleashing market forces in China were literally, ultimately, world-changing. What's the agenda, the reform agenda that Xi Jinping has laid out now for this next stretch?
Well, at the macro level, I think the key point is that the growth imperative, or the GDP is king kind of mentality, is over. China clearly has exited its double-digit growth era, and they're clearly slowing down, as many people are aware. Mm-hmm. So instead of in the 2000s, they could literally grow out of their problems because they were growing so fast. But now they cannot grow out of their problems. They must reform their way out of their problems. And what they're trying to do is basically seriously adjust their growth model from one that's predicated on heavy investment, capital-intensive investment, energy-intensive growth, to one that is more a domestic demand and consumption-driven, less based on investment and exports, more efficient allocation of capital, and a much more innovative and value-added economy. In some sense, it's moving, it's trying to become closer to, what other East Asian countries have done previously, like Japan and South Korea. So it's a huge monumental task. It's a $10 trillion economy now. It's not easy to turn the ship of state in China. So, but I think their ultimate goal is basically right. That's really the only way they can get over what economists call the middle income trap, which is about $10,000 per capita GDP, per capita income. And, not many countries have sort of gone above that. And so China is really at a point where they need to implement some significant reforms to get over that middle income trap.
David, Mike Lampton, what are the tensions or the challenges that that reform goal sets in front of the Communist Party and its rule of China?
Well, I would start with the thing that you're reading in the mass media quite frequently, is that this is the strongest leader since variously Mao Zedong or Deng Xiaoping. And on that, I would say it's way too soon to say that. Xi has taken on an enormous battle internally against networks, whether they be in the public security or the People's Liberation Army or provincially oriented networks. He's attacking a lot of powerful interests domestically, and he's doing so to win, I think, legitimacy at home because of corruption. And at the same time, because of all these tough battles and I think the aspirations of the Chinese people, he's fostering nationalism externally and building up military capacity. We've just seen the military budget rise another 10%. It's done so every year since 1990, except one. And so this creates anxiety among neighbors and more distant powers, Japan and the U.S., not the least. And therefore, he's got both powerful internal and external enemies. And Deng Xiaoping had a rule, and that is sort of don't bite off more than you can chew. Don't take on two enemies, too many enemies all at once. And as Susan's pointed out in some of her readings, there was a attempt to do things easy that would get you lots of political capital and then move on to harder things. I think many of us are very worried that she is taking on too many internal and external constituencies all at once, and therefore I think many of us are not absolutely convinced this strategy is going to work, although I agree with Damien's characterization that there is an underlying reform plan here that he's trying to push along. You asked what are some of the challenges, and beyond the macro political challenge and making foreigners adopt a more hostile policy, it seems to me there's a fundamental contradiction. He is mobilizing and talking more about ideological issues. He gave a speech in late last year called the Beijing Forum on Art and Literature. It really was very ideological in the sense of a speech Mao gave in 1942. And we've seen crackdowns, or let's say tightening up in universities and guidance from the central propaganda apparatus to tighten up. And one wonders, how is China going to move out of the middle income trap that Damien mentioned? How is it going to get higher value added? How is it going to be a more productive economy when it's going after the intellectuals and people that are going to be associated with that drive for productivity? So I don't see, I see him expending more political capital than maybe he has. I'm not sure, but you at least have to entertain that. And then how do you become a more productive middle-class society at the same time you're trying to contain and control the intellectuals and others that are going to be central to what China achieves in the future?
David McLampton, please stand by. We have to take a short break right here. David Lampton calling this one of the most interesting moments in China in decades, maybe a real tipping point. Susan Shirk talking about the potential for an elite coup in China. We'll come back and look at that. Xi Jinping, the big leader, has a very populist approach. Behind us right here, a popular Chinese song right now in tribute to him. He dares to beat any tiger, no matter how big the tiger is. Damien Ma, David Lampton, Susan Shirk, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's big anti-corruption campaign and a moment of big questions in China about the way ahead. Damien Ma joins us from the Paulson Institute in Chicago. David Mike Lampton from Johns Hopkins is here. Susan Shirk is with us from San Diego and UC San Diego. Behind a lot of this, a slowing Chinese economy. After a couple of decades of hyper growth, double-digit GDP growth, in his annual policy speech on Thursday to the National People's Congress, meeting in Beijing right now, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang lowered the country's growth target to around 7%. Anyplace else, that would be great. In China, that's a real slowdown. Here he is interpreted by the BBC.
The target growth rate of approximately 7% takes into consideration what is needed and what is possible. This target is both aligned with our goal of finishing building a moderately prosperous society in all respects and is appropriate in terms of the need to grow and upgrade our economy.
7%, that gets everyone's attention in China and beyond. At the end of last year, President Xi Jinping delivered a New Year's speech, promised to continue to fight against corruption, interpreted here by China Radio International.
In the past year, we endeavored to improve our work style and strengthen party and government discipline, with efforts focusing on fighting against formalism, bureaucracy, hedonism, and extravagance. The situation has greatly improved. We stepped up our efforts in our crackdown on corruption and severely punished corrupt officials with zero tolerance. This demonstrates that we are strongly committed to fighting against corruption and other evil forces.
Damien Ma in Chicago, here's a listener asking us online, saying that his impression is that corruption is nearly universal and that these arrests were mostly a matter of being out of favor with higher-ups and or being targeted by rivals. Do you see a genuine cleanup? Do you see a purge, Damien?
I think it's more the former. In terms of rivals, like I said earlier, there clearly is some of that. But if you look at the areas where the anti-corruption campaign has really hit, you've seen it in the oil and gas industry. You've seen it in some of the other major state-owned sectors. So I think that underscores the point that they are also trying to clean up the so-called vested interests where reform has been stalling. And, you know, like any major undertaking, there is bound to be resistance, political resistance. So if we accept the fact that reform, economic reform, is ultimately a political question, not an intellectual question, then some of these political tactics connected to the anti-corruption is going after some of these very strong, powerful state interests. And that's one way to demonopolize a lot of these sectors, and that's one way to push forward economic reforms.
I mean, Susan, implicit in our listeners' question is a sense that China's come through a Wild West period of hypergrowth, that in some ways there have been no clean hands. You look at this at the gathering, the National People's Congress in Beijing right now, and the New York Times reporting Michael Forsyth last week that in the U.S. Congress, Congressman Daryl Issa out of California would, I think he's worth about $450 million. He's the richest member of the U.S. Congress. In China's People's Congress, he would be the 166th richest member. That is full of billionaires. Are there clean hands here, Susan?
Well, I don't think we can assume that all the rich people in the National People's Congress are corrupt. But let's just look at officials now and the pervasiveness of corruption is very notable. I'm not sure that China is as corrupt as some other countries in other parts of the world, but definitely the level of corruption has increased. And, you know, this is also because of the nature of the Chinese economy, which brings us to Damien's argument about the connections between economic reform and the anti-corruption campaign, because one of the goals of the reforms is to reduce the government role in the economy and to reduce the number of approvals that businesses have to get for doing business, to get licensed for this or that, to get listed on the stock market, et cetera. So in a system like China's, which still has a very heavy hand of the government bureaucracy, there are just so many opportunities for officials to, you know, put out their hand and to require a payoff in order to do the normal business of government. In the Mao era, the way the elite carried out internal competition struggle was through ideological campaigns of attacking rivals by being capitalist rotors or bourgeois or, you know, using these kind of ideological attacks. That no longer goes on, thank goodness, but the mode of combat now is the anti-corruption campaign because, as you note, practically everybody, even if they themselves are pretty clean, their relatives probably are not. So everyone is vulnerable.
David, Michael Lampton, is it clear that there's been a political coloration to this? I mean, it's gone after very high officials, and it's gone after military leaders, 14 generals caught up in this in the last headline that I saw. Do you see a weeding out ideologically woven through the anti-corruption campaign, Mike?
Well, I think if you start from the premise that there are, as the questioner or the person that posed the answer suggested, there's widespread corruption, you have lots of targets to choose from. And so I think this is a combination of weeding out corruption to enhance both the performance of the system and legitimacy. But it's also, because there are so many targets, I think Xi Jinping is also targeting those networks that are the greatest threat to his power. And so between targeting both corruption in general and these networks, of course, he's creating a lot of anxiety. And you hear now that people are hesitating to take bold action, keep their head down, wait for a better day, this kind of defensive reaction of people who aren't sure where things are going can end up creating a kind of lethargy in the system, and lots of Chinese are privately talking about that. So I think you can't disentangle the objective from attacking corruption as a threat to the performance and legitimacy from the power objectives that he has. And if you were just using the corruption campaign to consolidate your power, you'd go after the PLA, the energy area, certain key provinces, the public security, and so forth. And those are importantly areas he's gone after first. So I don't think you can disentangle it. One thing I wanted to say apropos is this part of a larger precondition or process of reform. And that is that, yes, they are prosecuting these people, but at least thus far, they're using the non-transparent sort of the party disciplinary apparatus to go after people. And so this isn't, hauling people before regular transparent judicial process as we think of it here. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't necessarily lead to, an independent judiciary and all of the things we associate with a more vigorous an objective and fair legal system. So the dilemma really is how do you clean up a dirty system without maintaining the same dirty tools that you've survived for the last 40 years? And what's kind of concerning to a lot of us is we have a reform vocabulary, but we have an old political playbook here.
Damien Ma, it's been said that China won't work without that sort of dirty part of the system. That's been the grease that's made everything go, and without that, the economy doesn't work. What about that argument, Damien?
Well, I think it is absolutely true that corruption has a long history in China and also in other countries as well as has been suggested. So I think the difference is whether corruption is, sort of low retail level corruption that kind of greases the economic wheel. You pay off a local level cadre to get something done. But it doesn't tip into sort of the endemic systemic level, which I think is what the Communist Party is concerned about, that it's tipping there. And so they really need to do something about it because then it will have a much bigger systemic effect when corruption becomes a way to exacerbate inequality, for example, or to prevent upward mobility for the average Chinese. Then that becomes a much larger, broader economic and political issue. And so, that's why I think President Xi and others have really portrayed this campaign in very stark language. They literally talk about cutting out the cancer. It's sort of like a performing a surgery on themselves, since, as Dave has mentioned, there's no external checks. So the only way to do it is to really check the Communist Party itself by itself, and to perform these sort of painful surgeries on the party. And that's the way they're thinking about it, and that's why this is really turning into one of the most ferocious and intense campaigns we've seen in a very long time.
David, Mike Lampton, you've talked about this being one of the most interesting moments in China in decades, potentially a real tipping point. Between what or what? What are the poles here that things could go toward one way or another, David?
Well, the reason I say that is if you look at the sequence of leaders from Mao to Deng to Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao, and now we have Xi Jinping, Xi Jinping's predecessors basically presided over a process of social and I would say political change in China. China's leaders became weaker. Relatively speaking, certainly compared to Mao over time. The bureaucracy and society became more pluralized, fragmented, divided, interest group driven. And society became more empowered in the sense of having human resources in localities that could be mobilized, information, capital, knowledge, social networking technology. So you had weaker leaders, more fragmented society, bureaucracy, stronger society. And therefore, I think it was the expectation of many of us that you would, over time, develop a leadership style that was more accommodating, norm-driven, rule-driven, sort of constitutionally governed in sorts. And what we see is Xi, I think, trying to, in a sense, reverse that, to get control over an empowered society, whether it's through control of the internet and so forth. You see this campaign's trying to get a handle on the bureaucracy. He's grabbed into his hands the chairmanship of almost every important bureaucratic coordinating committee on the organizational map. And at some point, you just have to ask, is this a feasible span of control? And is a society and polity that's changed so much over the last 40 years going to comfortably entertain this mode of leadership? And by asking the question, I'm not saying the answer is certainly no, but the answer could be no. And if we have a leadership style that's trying to impose itself on a society that's fundamentally unwilling to accept it in the long run, then we have to ask what's plan B and what's going to happen. And I think that's why we're all very uncertain. You mentioned the Shambaugh piece up front. I think he sees the crack up, so to speak, as much more imminent than I think likely. I think it's much more open-ended set of possibilities. And he's one, I would say, probably low probability description of it, but he's very right to ask the questions and be concerned.
Let me go to a few of our listeners here. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for the discussion. I'd just like to say, we're talking about this, I'm listening to this, and I'm wondering, where is the voice of the Chinese people that are being discriminated against and put in jail? Let's be talking with them, because people are talking to each other all over the world despite the authorities. And I'm wondering, how would these people have a voice in the American media, for instance?
Or in their own country. Bob, let us pick it up right there. Susan Shirk, what about it? In this time, and there has been a crackdown on dissent of many kinds, I mean, just looking over the weekend here, China detaining women's rights activists in all kinds of directions. We had this big documentary on air pollution in China that got so much attention. Then the end of last week, kind of a crackdown, almost a ban on that. Bob in Oklahoma wonders, where's the voice of the Chinese people in this period of ferment, Susan?
Well, this degree of repression really does signal an insecure leadership, not a confident leadership, for sure. So I think we should recognize that. And the rules of what is acceptable criticism and discussion of problems in China appears to have changed from the Hu Jintao era, the last administration, and the Xi Jinping era. In the Hu Jintao era, people were encouraged to reveal corruption on the microblogs, this kind of bottom-up monitoring of the behavior of officials was permitted, even encouraged. But Xi Jinping is trying to do everything top-down. And he's shutting off the Weibo. The Weibo now is so highly censored that it's too risky for people to post a lot of these kinds of critiques.
The online forum, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the repressiveness over society, over debate, has definitely gotten stronger. Now, it's wrong to overdo that at the intellectual level. There's still a debate, you know, that you can track. But ordinary people, I think the avenues for publicly talking about problems has definitely shrunk.
Susan Shirk, please stand by in San Diego. David, Mike Lampton in Washington. Damian Ma in Chicago. We're looking at China's big anti-corruption campaign and a big moment of questions about China's future right now. Xi Jinping, populist leader, yes, crackdown, but also a lot of populist support, popular songs out there. Here's one about the love between China's president and his wife. Went viral in China online last year. Men should study him and women should study her, love like they do. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's big anti-corruption campaign and a moment of big questions in China about the way ahead. Damian Ma is with us today at the Paulson Institute, joins us from Chicago. David Mike Lampton is with us, chairman of the Asia Foundation at Johns Hopkins as well. Susan Shirk is here from UC San Diego. Huge viral attention paid in recent weeks to a documentary by a very prominent Chinese journalist, Chai Jing, called Under the Dome, about the severity of China's air pollution problem, quickly went viral, came out just last month. Then last Friday, Chinese authorities ordered all news outlets and internet services to take the film down, shove it into the corner, stop reporting on it. In the film, here's Chai Jing showing a series of pictures of Beijing.
This is 2014, 整整一年的北京.
She said the photos show each day of 2014 in Beijing. I only brought my daughter outside on days when the air quality was good. But how often do we have those good days, she asks. She says there were 175 polluted days in 2014. That meant for almost half the year, I had no choice but to keep my daughter inside like a prisoner. Chinese people were eating this documentary up like crazy. Now it's been shunted to the side. Damian Ma, what does that tell you about, maybe it speaks to our caller from Oklahoma and his question about the voice of the Chinese people. They were eager to see this documentary, which was very unusually outspoken about the severe degree of air pollution in China. Now it's been put aside. What does this story tell you, Damian?
Well, I think you're certainly right that pollution has really risen to one of the top priorities for the top leadership. It's a big social and political issue, and in fact, it's an issue that the Paulson Institute has been working on. In terms of the documentary itself, I think it was a little, you know, they pulled it, too late, essentially, because, you know, I think over the weekend there was something like 100 million or 200 million hits already. So that was already viral.
It's been seen,
yeah. So I think they let it run, and I think these kinds of tactics isn't beyond what the propaganda apparatus has done in the past. They sort of, let it test the water, see how it goes. And once they decide that the discussion or debate has become too fierce, too political, then they pull the plug. But I think this time there were certainly clearly some political motivations behind it. And I think certain people really wanted this to be up there for as long as possible. And I think they essentially achieved it. So I'm not sure pulling the plug after 200 million hits is really that effective.
How do you move toward the more nimble, innovative economy that you say China wants to become now, which requires the input from lots of at least sort of free-thinking citizens, and have this kind of control on dissent at the same time, Damian? Are those compatible?
On face value, I don't think they are compatible. But I think, you know, if you talk to – if you really get into the Chinese society and talk to your average Chinese, they're pretty dynamic conversation going on about all sorts of things, pollution, corruption, all the top issues that are of concern to the average Chinese. And I think that's also why the top leadership is paying attention. They're constantly monitoring public opinion. So they're certainly not blind to the fact that these are major public concerns, and that's why they've elevated it to a political level that's unprecedented for some of these issues. So Chinese people do find a way. Many of them do actually climb the great firewall, so to speak. Look, the censorship is always imperfect, and the great firewall is porous, so information does get in and out. It's always been a cat and mouse game of, the conversation going to a place and then the propaganda or censorship tries to catch up. So it's a very delicate balance. But I think I would say the bottom line here is that the actual debate and conversation in Chinese society is pretty vibrant and pretty dynamic.
The great firewall of pretty massive controls at the same time on the Internet. Joan in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Joan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, and thank you for the program. I really appreciate it, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to deal with, buy Chinese things in the big box stores and so forth. But they have a problem with quality control. They should address that. Ever since World War II, their products have been considered shoddy, and that has not changed. I span that lifetime. And I buy, a pair of slippers, and then I see what's inside of them, and I really almost want to throw up. I mean, what material they use to make them. And if they could put in quality control, I think that's an issue. Instead of cheating on quality, they'd be improving their, economy by having outside countries buy more.
Well, John, I think they've done pretty well on that front. I mean, I take your point, but they've moved way up the kind of pyramid of products that China produces, and heaven knows they've sold a lot abroad. Let me hold that thought. Thank you, Joan, and get one more. Michael in Nashua, New Hampshire. Michael, you're on the air.
My comment is regarding America's meddling in other countries' internal affairs. We've surrounded China with military bases, our pivot to Asia, and therefore we're starting to meddle in Chinese affairs, thus the show. It's time America thought about America and building our infrastructure and improving our lives here.
Michael, I'm all about looking at the United States, and we do, and many, many, as you know, if you listen hours on this show, but you know, we've thought for a long time that it kind of matters what the political openness of the whole world is. I mean, if there's repression, I think I heard that word in this hour somewhere, it may come back and bite us here. Isn't it a legitimate concern how much freedom or otherwise we see around the world and in our own country?
Well, so far, United States meddled in Libya and Iraq and other Middle East countries, and I think the result has been very poor at best. So if we're going to judge by how America involves itself around the world, we should take a look at the results that we've had over the last 30 years and then go from there forward.
Michael, I appreciate your call. Mike Lampton, how about it? U.S. attention to China's internal domestic affairs. I mean, you're a scholar, so of course you do it by necessity.
Mm-hmm.
But traditionally, we've thought the politics of everyone in the world mattered to everyone else ultimately. How do you look at China? The Chinese government would say, stay out of our business.
Well, first of all, I understand what the caller means, and certainly just looking at the macro picture, the United States is engaged in very debilitating ways and sapping ways in multiple locations. So certainly agree with the impulse and the desire to have better governance here.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two words that I think are very important, globalization and interdependence. And your previous caller mentioned product quality. If China doesn't have a FDA, Food and Drug Administration function, and is exporting food that, like pet food, killing pets around the world, or toothpaste with radiator fluid in it and so forth, and killing people in South America or elsewhere, this is a legitimate concern of countries around the world, not least the United States. So the whole global supply chain has given the whole world an interest in how well China regulates its participation in its global economy. And I went with a couple of congressmen on this issue, and they brought up this whole issue of product quality and so on. And when we met Chinese citizens outside these official meetings, they all said, we hope you push as hard as you can on our government, because we're consuming the same products and we don't have a voice. So I'm sympathetic to the sort of orientation of the caller. And also, we are dependent very importantly on capital outflows from China and treasury borrowings and so forth. We've got to care about the solvency of the Chinese banking system. And if we see practices there that are inconsistent with solvency, fully recognizing we've had our own problems, to put it mildly, I think we have a right to articulate those interests. So I think globalization and interdependence have made this notion that we don't have a rightful voice in somebody else's governing system not a very useful way to proceed.
John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
And thank you for taking my comment. By training, I'm a Russian-Soviet specialist. Mm-hmm. And from that perspective, it seems to me like the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Communist Party of China, lacks legitimacy. I would just cite the fact, as far as I can determine, that as a result of policies of that party in China, they killed more people in the 20th century than the Japanese did in their aggression against China. And it seems to me that the real conundrum of the problem they have is, in fact, that and their political system and its lack of legitimacy.
But here we are in 2015, John. Those huge numbers of dead are in the rearview mirror. There was a lot of trouble in the 20th century. Do you think that that legacy is somehow still at the heart of their problem? The China has certainly advanced a long way economically.
Well, you mentioned the movie Under the Dome,
mm-hmm.
and I saw parallels with Chernobyl. I think that I was in the Soviet Union where Chernobyl occurred, and one of my conclusions was that the people there came to the conclusion that the regime was killing them. And it seems to me that you could say a similar process is underway in terms of the pollution problem.
Wow, that is interesting. Susan Shirk, equating China's severe air pollution, and it is a real health threat, with Chernobyl and even with internal purges and large-scale death of decades back.
I think that is a very chilling and apt comparison, and one that I just jotted down to remember and think more about. But let's remember the Soviet Union, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, didn't fall because of a mass revolution. It fell because of an elite coup, really. And I think that is the greatest risk in China as well. But the legacy of the Mao era is definitely still with us in China. I mean, one of the puzzles about the way Xi Jinping is governing that has really perplexed me is why he has harkened back to Mao-era ideological slogans.
When his own family suffered, his father suffered under Mao. He's a princely.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He was a victim, mm-hmm. and his father was a victim. And, you know, I've really wondered about that. Now, Damien might say, well, Deng Xiaoping also, despite his quite thoroughgoing critique of the Mao style of governing that he made soon after Mao Zedong died, he still kind of turned left in ideological terms whenever he felt the need to appease some of the harder line conservative voices within the Communist Party in order to push forward his market reforms. There was a leader named Chen Yun who was very powerful, almost as powerful as Deng Xiaoping, who from time to time Deng had to appease. But there's no Chen Yun today, as far as I can tell. There's no major figure challenging Xi, constraining Xi, who takes a hardline ideological position. So Xi's pushing these Mao-era notions is really very puzzling. And I've concluded tentatively that perhaps they still have a lot of traction with the Chinese public. You'd think the public would be so glad to leave behind all of the Mao-era struggles and ideological conformity and really enjoy the freedom that a market system gives them. But because perhaps there's been no education of younger generations about the tragedies, the deaths, the victims of Mao-era China, the violence, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, younger generations don't learn anything about this. And many of their parents don't really want to go back and talk about it very much because it's too painful.
Susan, you use the phrase elite coup again. If that happened, what might that look like? And what might it mean for China if there were a kind of toppling from the top?
Well, I've been trying to think about what that might look like. You know, it could be done very secretly within the Politburo or the Standing Committee.
You mean Xi Jinping has decided to spend more time with his family and won't be with us today or ever again?
Well, I mean, they could slap him down with and still leave him in power, perhaps. You know, or they could say at the end of this 5 years, it's time for someone else to take over, whereas the norm has become serving 2 5-year terms or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there'd be a temptation to try to reach out to the public when we saw that happening, remember, with Bo Xilai, an ambitious politician who tried to move up to the Standing Committee by mobilizing a popular following.
Mm-hmm.
So, but on the other hand, with Xi Jinping being so popular now, that doesn't seem like a very good approach for a challenger to Xi Jinping. On the other hand, that popularity may not last that long, especially if there's a downturn in the real estate market. People see their savings evaporating because even middle-class people, their savings is mostly in real estate. Or other economic problems that cause real distress. The public could turn against Xi Jinping in a short period of time. It's hard to say.
Susan Shirk, stand by. We're out of time right there. What a fascinating conversation about a really interesting moment in China. Susan Shirk at UC San Diego, David, Mike Lampton at Johns Hopkins, and Damian Ma at the Paulson Institute in Chicago. We are grateful to each of you. Thank you so much for coming on today. Listeners, thanks for joining us for A Glimpse of China. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.